I confess, as your adopted Baptist son, that as a kid growing up, sitting in the balcony in a Baptist church, when we got to this song, all the kids would be doing like this. And it's hard for me not to sing this song and not be rocking back and forth. So, this has been a hard week for us, for all of us. There's a lot going on. And I feel compelled to talk about it and put it in some context for us. Before I begin, I do want to extend a word of gratitude to the Bell Choir for the selection that they will play later about the innocents. I hope that you'll read in the program, not during the sermon, but the background of this piece, because I think it's important. And while they chose this many weeks ago, I think the hand of God was at work in their selection. It is a beautiful, beautiful piece, and I thank them for doing this for us. This is the first Sunday of Lent, a time we set aside each year for reflection on our attempts to align ourselves more completely with God's love for us. I can think of no better passages by which we might do so than those two passages that we read today. They're also important as we try and make sense of what is happening in the world around us. Genesis tells a story of the world right after the great flood. In light of the storms and floods our nation has endured recently, we might have an inkling of the devastation that Noah and his family faced. But of course, for Noah, it was the whole world, not a neighborhood, not an island. And there was something else. There was something else. Imagine this. It's a few months after Noah's ark landed. Things are drying up and they are trying to put their lives back together. And then imagine that Noah sees a dark cloud on the horizon and hears the rumble of thunder. What do you suspect is running through his mind? It's not hard to envision him crying out, "Not again, not again," and falling down, weeping in a heap of despair. Not again. But Genesis tells a different story. Noah had no need to worry. He knew it wouldn't flood again. Something was different. What was it? What was different? Had humanity reformed and abandoned its sinful ways? Alas, no. We know it isn't humanity. This post-flood world is no paradise regained. And a drunken and cursing Noah makes that fact certain in the next chapter. What was it then? What was different? God had changed. The narrative tells us that God considered the flood, regretted it, and then made an astounding promise, a covenant, that it would never happen again. The rainbow becomes an enduring sign of God's remembering of this covenant, of the change of mind. The word covenant appears 7 times in this short passage. 7 times. Now, there are several good sermons here, and as a former seminary president, I've seen a lot of folks take a crack at this one. But I think there is something we should not miss. And if there's one thing I need you to remember about today, it's this. God is a God who is moved. God is a God who is moved. The picture we get in this story of God, as we do in most of the Hebrew scriptures, is one that runs counter to all the characterizations of those omni categories that are put on God. Traditionally, we say God is omnipresent, God is omniscient, God is omnipotent. In the words of the old hymn, immortal, invisible, God only wise, light inaccessible. It's a very Greek image, like Aristotle's unmoved mover in his Metaphysics. But the biblical flood story reveals a God of a different sort, a God who chooses to be in relationship with us, which, as Walter Brueggemann has observed, makes it impossible for this God to be settled, static, or fixed. Importantly for us, and rather remarkably, we see a God who regrets, who grieves, and needs to remember. It's a God who puts a rainbow in the sky to remind herself of the promises she makes. It's a celestial ring, a string around God's finger. Let me remind myself. What an astounding alternative image it is. Here is a personal God with emotions, who aches like a mother for a loving relationship with her children. In the words of Rabbi Abraham Heschel, this is not a distant and removed God, but rather the most moved mover. The most moved mover. This image shapes our understanding of the entire passage about the covenant God established with Noah and all creation. The word covenant is one we've heard plenty of times. And for most, it's an agreement, or in the church world, a sacred bond regarding behavior or interactions between two parties. When we use the word covenant, we mean more than a legal contract. There is something ethical and emotional tied up in it, if not sacred. Perhaps that's why we described marriage as a covenant, and why our ideas of fidelity are based on a commitment to keeping the promises of that covenant, which we see as far more than a business deal. Of course, there are a few who have reduced marriage to a business deal, but we have no admiration or respect for them precisely because of the absence of these more meaningful elements. There's something even more striking about this covenant that God establishes in Genesis, however. In most of our minds, a covenant involves two equal parties. My obligations are dependent upon your fidelity to yours. Yet we see in this passage that God, who has all the power, makes a promise freely, no strings attached. God is self-limiting. This is entirely God's doing. It's done in full knowledge of the sinfulness of humanity and the near certainty that we will fall short. God is saying, in effect, I will not give up on you. I will not give up on you. Or trying to love you into a restoration of our relationship. It is a telling insight of who God is is it at this point, then, that the words from Paul's letter to the church in Ephesus are invaluable. Facing this controversy with Jewish Christians of whether Gentiles should be included in the Christian faith, Paul, a former well-schooled Pharisee, invites those who would exclude the Gentiles to remember the wider dimension of God's covenant. Tracing covenant history back through Noah and Abraham and Moses, the Jews, Jewish Christians, were obsessed with what it meant to be a chosen people. They felt they occupied a privileged place by their strict adherence to the law and believed that only practicing Jews could participate in this new emerging faith community. But Paul, by appealing to a new reality in Jesus, says that those who were once alienated from the covenant are now reconciled and belong in the family. Old laws being used to keep Gentiles out of the promises have been washed away, he said. The dividing wall had been broken down. In those magnificent words, he says to the Gentiles, "So you are no longer strangers and sojourners, but are fellow citizens with the saints and the members of the household of God." Wow, powerful stuff. Powerful stuff. You are no longer strangers and sojourners, but are fellow citizens with the saints and the members of the household of God. The God who loves us and yearns to be in relationship with us welcomes all and has gone so far as to become flesh in Jesus to make that relationship possible. The phrase "citizens in the household of God" is critical. What does it mean to be a citizen in the household of God? It means that the walls are down. It means that the doors are open and all creation is included. By faith alone, each one of us is a part of God's family and heir to the promises. This is God's initiative alone. It's not a deal. We negotiated. God didn't read The Art of the Deal. All we can do in this circumstance is respond in joy and in gratitude. Granted this precious citizenship, we commit to embody for each other the same inclusiveness, peace, and love that God has so graciously offered us in Jesus. We do this because of our thankfulness. But that thankfulness will be meaningless if God's love isn't reflected in our own lives. We have been forced from flood, we have been freed from flood and fear. Shall we not show it? Shall we not show it? In order to do so, we have to come to terms with the hard lessons that the people of Israel had to learn from the prophets, which was this: you are chosen not for special privilege, but for special responsibility. You are chosen not for special privilege, but for special responsibility. One of the great risks of a covenant like this is that the recipients believe that they have been let off the hook, that they're immune, and that they're among the elite. And as soon as that happens, the very heart of God's intention begins to be distorted. God seeks a loving and just relationship with and among us, not the abuse of a relationship. God seeks servants, not masters. This is what righteous living is all about. Time and again, speaking through the prophets, God chastised the people of Israel for their failure to understand this one truth. As you read Jeremiah and Isaiah and Joel and Amos, you'll see that they all condemned Israel for its hypocrisy and confronted their separation of their espoused faith with their practice of faith. And this, we know, was at the very heart of Jesus' contention with the Pharisees, whose legalisms betrayed the essence of a loving covenant. Such distortions of the covenant are a source of great sorrow to God. It is at this point that the image of a personal, emotion-filled God is so helpful. A warm and loving parent rather than a cold, removed judge. It is the same loving God, the one he called Abba, Father, that Jesus revealed to us in his compassion, his love, and his tears. It is a God who cares for us, and like a loving mother who dreams for her child's fulfillment. But notice that it is a God who self-limits so that the child's, the creation's offspring can be fulfilled and be genuine, not engineered. A child cannot learn to ride a bike until the parent lets go, and the child has the freedom to learn and be independent, even at the risk of falling. It is the gift of freedom that weighs the heaviest. Any of us who have been in that situation to let that bicycle go knows that moment of letting your child go and giving them what you want for them, terrified that they'll fall, but knowing that if you hang on, they will never get the freedom they seek. Such is the nature of this covenant that God makes with us. It is personal. In light of what have happened this week, I have to be specific about our personal God. It is the God of the covenant who weeps for the murdered children and the families in Florida, tears that have flowed far too many times in recent years. God is not the unmoved mover who causes these things to happen, but is the first one whose heart breaks. It is a God whose own voice is echoed in the agonized cries of Florida parents and all those who have lost loved ones in these senseless massacres. It is a God who is affronted by a nation's idolatrous and abusive love affair with guns and violence such that we are willing to sacrifice our most innocent on its altar. It is a God who is insulted by those who offer soulless prayers over which they are unwilling to do anything about. Stop! Stop! I love you, cries the God of our covenant. Stop! You are breaking my heart. Why do you choose other gods? You and I are citizens of the household of God. Through faith, we are heirs to the covenant, and because of it, we are children of the light, not children of the darkness. The rainbow is a reminder of our divine promise. Are we not blessed? Our calling is to bring joy to God's heart, not sorrow. Are we not sowers of goodness? Our duty is to honor, not to scorn or mock our Creator. Are we not ambassadors of glory? The dimensions of our faithfulness and commitment to God should know no bounds, no borders, no fears. Are we not emissaries of peace? No one should be forced to collapse in despair, crying, "Not again, not again." Are we not harbingers of hope? God has chosen you and me. We are citizens in the household of God. Shall we not be worthy of it? Amen.